You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 15th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. The Stack is brought to you in association with J.Crew.
Something from Germany to sink your teeth into for the holiday season. The editor of a magazine with a sunny take on the world and a gentleman photographer who's taken on a particularly challenging assignment in Iraq. Those stories and shelves more today on edition 16 of The Stack. Also coming up, we meet the creators of Gather Journal, a biannual magazine devoted to foraging, preparing, cooking, and, well, gathering.
We want people to feel inspired to cook, and so on a visual side of it, we work with some really amazing food photographers just to create sort of this experience that's emotional, but also visually, I don't know, exciting.
And we'll be talking to the editor of one of the world's most iconic newsweeklies, Olivier Royan of Paris Match.
I think there are two kinds of media these days. The media who have the capabilities and the resources to report their own news, which means sending people on the field. And you have the media commenting about the news that other media bring back. So we are definitely in the first category.
All that and much more today from the world of publishing, live here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 16 of The Stack. I'm Tyler Brulé. Earlier on during the week, we were paid a visit by an editor-in-chief who not only managed to put a positive spin on France, but also the state of journalism in his republic. Every week, Paris Match hits the streets and letterboxes with its very particular mix of long-lens photography, big-budget reportage, the odd scandal, and plenty to inform and entertain. Behind the scenes, editor-in-chief Olivier Royan always has two standby teams of photographers and journalists ready to fly anywhere in the world to report on breaking news or score a big scoop. In this era of publishers moving out of original reporting, it was a welcome bit of news, and we'll have more from Monsieur Royan a bit later in the program. But first, let's meet our guests assembled around the table here in Studio One. Well, we have Sebastian Meyer joining us over to the left of the table here in Studio One. Sebastian is an award-winning photographer turned multimedia journalist and co-founder of Metrography, the first Iraqi photo agency. Sebastian's photographs have been published in the New York Times, Time Magazine, Sunday Times Magazine, The Telegraph, The Guardian, Washington Post. We can go on and on. Welcome to The Stack. Good morning.
Thank you very much.
Now, tell us, the world of photo agencies is a crowded one, but it's also one which is consolidating a lot. We've seen a number of high-scale or big-scale takeovers. What was the idea of and what did you see in Iraq in terms of an opportunity? Nothing had been there before?
Absolutely. The idea actually stemmed from my co-founder, an Iraqi photographer, who was working for a local, an Iraqi fortnightly magazine. And his job as a photo editor was just to source pictures from Iraq. Now, if you're working for an international publication, you're going to look for pictures of war, you're going to look at pictures that are going to make international news. But he was doing a magazine for Iraqis. So he had to source pictures of politics, he had to source pictures of food, of anything that would go in a magazine that Iraqis would be interested in. And he realized that there was no central place to get images from. So he was pulling from all sorts of different people and found it very difficult. And he said, why is there no central place that I can go for pictures from Iraq? And then a colleague of his, who was an old BBC journalist, said, well, just start your own. So when I moved there in 2009, he said, would you be interested in joining me? I said, absolutely, sounds fantastic. And then from there, so the last 3 years, we sort of built this agency. It's going really well. We've had to find our feet a little bit because we tried some breaking news. You can't compete with The Wires. We just don't have the resources for breaking news. And to be honest, we don't need to do that.
But are there a lot of things also that The Wires, let's say, aren't doing as well? Because, I mean, The Wires are primarily, I guess, looking for stories to export on a global level.
Absolutely. But even within that, wire photography, it tends to be single-shot photography, it's breaking news photography, it's politics, is war, is tiny bit of daily life. I mean, let's use Monocle magazine as an example. You guys have run three stories, or about to run your third story on Iraq. Every of those three stories, I've shot one, and my colleague Kamran, Iraqi photographer, has shot the other two. So the need for long form photojournalism is there, and we're the only place that can offer that. And we're training Iraqi photographers to shoot that because that's just not there. And in a place like Iraq, where security is an issue, translation's an issue, bureaucracy is probably the biggest issue. I mean, it takes at least 2 months to get a visa.
Mm.
So if you're on a relatively tight deadline, I mean, you need to do it within 2 months, you're going to have to use an Iraqi photographer. And that's where we come in.
Well, as I was mentioning in the intro, we're going to be talking a little bit later. It'll be interesting to hear your views when we speak to Olivier Hoyon from Paris Match, just because he talks about just the scale of the stories that, you know, that they still go out and do. I guess, mm-hmm. you know, one of the few magazines that is doing grand reportage. I also want to introduce Charlotte Jacqueline, editor of Betty magazine. Betty's an independent magazine and blog where you can expect, of course, find fashion, music, culture, lifestyle, and much more. But as I said in the intro, there's something quite interesting about where you've pitched yourself. Women's publishing, when you mention sort of style, lifestyle, fashion, an incredibly crowded market, both in the traditional area of the Vogues and the Elles and the Mary Claires. But, you know, there's been just an incredible spike also in new independent titles as well. But what's interesting when you look at Betty is that you have this very sunny, positive, optimistic view on the world. At least that's when I've looked at copies. Where do you pitch yourself?
In our own niche, really. I think you're right, it is a very overcrowded market and there's been a big spike recently. But I think we're speaking to a unique kind of girl. She's very intelligent. There's, you know, it is very busy out there, all the messages. So we don't pitch ourselves anywhere in particular. We just do things that we believe in and that we want to share with people. And luckily our readers engage and enjoy that, really.
Was there a frustration? I guess it's always the part of an editor-in-chief or founder publisher. What were you seeing or not seeing on the newsstand? And you know, where is the gap that you're filling at the moment, do you think?
When I started Betty, which was 3 years ago, it was a university project, which is its conception, I wasn't seeing anything that I wanted to pick up and read. There was a lot of new weekly magazines, a lot of kind of negative, you know, I pick up a magazine, I read the magazine, and by the time I've read it, I want to go and do some new exercise, I want to go buy some new makeup, I want to go and buy a new pair of shoes. And there was nothing positive coming out of that. It was just consume, and throw away. You know, the fashion's becoming quicker, the magazines were becoming weekly. And I want something where you can sit down and go to it 6 months later and still find something relevant. Rip it out, put it in your kitchen wall, put it in your cookery books.
Sebastian, tell me, when you look at a market like Iraq, and you know, one which has had to completely, you know, re-kickstart itself, and you talk about sort of the opportunity that was there, is part of that, you know, from the fact that, you know, here's a country which is, you know, completely, you know, attempting to come into its own again. Does that mean then there's also been, you know, of course, a surge in, you know, new newspapers, new magazines out there, where you, in many ways, you have an instant market?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The problem that we face is that the local Iraqi media has boomed. And everyone saw that immediately after the invasion. Suddenly satellite dishes that had never seen before mushroomed, and anywhere you go in Iraq, it's just satellite dishes. I've seen refugees who pack up their entire house, put it in a car, but make sure they bring the satellite dish with them. You know, people living in UNHCR tents have a satellite dish. And the same thing applies for the news media, especially up in the Kurdish region. There is a boom. The problem is that they've entered the market the world of news media at the same time as, you know, we in the as the West is facing all this online problems and the marketability of it. So internet is pretty successful in Iraq. Everybody uses Facebook, everybody reads their news online. So the print version, although there's been a big increase in it, is limited. And the resources are limited.
Mm. Tell me though, when you mentioned, of course, you know, the rise of social media, things like that. Does that also mean that there is, I guess, you know, more opportunities for, you know, publishers to, in a way, you know, self-commission their photography, that they're using a lot of user-generated content. I imagine when probably budgets are squeezed. And, you know, with a new agency, how does that allow you cut through? And I guess the second question is, how much of your revenue, if you're allowed to say, mm-hmm. is coming from domestic commissions versus international?
When we first started the agency, the idea was to really focus on both international and domestic within Iraq. And we realized very quickly that as an agency, if we were going to take a cut, our photographers wouldn't make any money. Mm. The domestic market doesn't exist for photography. Just because of everyone's got an iPhone or a BlackBerry or, you know, some smartphone, and they're just not interested and they don't have the budgets to pay for photography. So in terms of our revenue source, we do everything internationally. We can't actually make money selling domestically.
Tell me, Charlotte, with Betty, I sort of pose the same type of question right now as well. Just given the sophistication of what, you know, devices like this can do at the moment, how do you sort of look at the whole approach to art direction? What you take from, you know, potentially from readers, real rank amateurs, versus then giving, you know, a leg up to emerging photographers who really want to craft their talent, or illustrators, etc.
Well, we get a massive amount of people approaching us wanting to work for us, and it's just our creative director, Charlotte Melling, has worked as an interior stylist for years and years, so she's kind of got the eye of people to work with. But we work on a kind of a love for the magazine at the moment. You know, we're not making incredible amounts of money, so everybody kind of sees it as a portfolio platform and a way to kind of get your work displayed in other countries, Japan, Singapore, and around the world that we wouldn't have at such a young age in our careers.
Mm. I thought we'd kick off and maybe just talk about one title, which is gathering a lot of attention. It can be somewhat inconvenient to read a magazine that immediately makes you want to rush to the kitchen and start cooking, but that's exactly what Gather Journal does. It's a biannual magazine founded by art director Michelle Outland and editor Fiorella Valdesolo, and the latest issue of the very, very popular magazine just hit newsstands. It's filled with recipes for everything from squid ink pasta to maple semifreddo cookies. It's printed in Canada on a wonderful stock from, of course, a sustainable mill, and Gather is the kind of journal readers will keep on their shelves for years to come. Our New York bureau chief, Aisha Spears, caught up with Michelle and Fiorella over breakfast to find out what made them cook up the magazine.
Gather is a recipe-driven food magazine. We're coming out twice a year. I think for us, the recipe format was really important because we want it to have a bit of a shelf life more than the average food magazine does, and people can refer to it again and again. So it's kind of is kind of a cross between a magazine and a cookbook at the same time. The text is short, it's kind of whimsical, very nostalgic.
You know, also we want people to feel inspired to cook. And so on a visual side of it, you know, we've worked with some really amazing food photographers and just to create sort of this experience that's emotional, but also just wants, you know, I think it's just visually, I don't know, exciting.
Yeah. Where do you see Gather fitting into food magazines that other people may or may not be keeping on their shelves? I certainly keep my Bon Appetit because I want the recipe. Mm-hmm. Do you see yourself going more into other editorial feature stuff, or you want to stay as a menu-based magazine?
I think we are probably, the recipe-driven format, I think, is really, really important to us. Just because I think it differentiates us in a lot of ways. I think something like Canal House Cooks does something similar to that, which we love what they do, but I think it's kind of bridging these two worlds. So I think we're staying with that format. It's been really effective for us, and I think it, a lot of different people respond to it in that way.
And I think the editorial tone is also, we also wanted to make something that spoke to us and our friends and our circle of friends. And so I think with what you create with the editorial tone and maybe what I create visually, I think it a little bit is speaking to our generation a little bit, but I think, you know, we first and foremost want people to cook from it, mm-hmm. you know, no matter what age you are. Mm-hmm. So I hope that's what that inspires, but I also like the voice of our magazine mm-hmm. in terms of where it is. I think it has really interesting, you know, food lessons and things like that, but I think, you know, you bring a really funny voice to it also. Like, it's looser.
Where do you find the recipes, and how do you kind of choose what goes in there?
Well, we work with two recipe developers, Maggie Ruggiero and Molly Schuster. Maggie was on staff at Gourmet for 7 years, so she has a really great wealth of experience for recipe development and recipe styling. So she styles all of the food in the magazine as well. So we come up with the concept. You can explain more.
Well, the first thing we do each issue is come up with a theme. And so far, the first one was float, and this one is traces. We want it to be just kind of a loose idea that can inspire a variety of recipes and pieces of text. And then for food, we sit down and we probably have a conversation first about what we want it to be, and then Maggie kind of brings us back down to earth about what's possible. And then it continues that way, and then she edits it down.
Maggie and Molly work Maggie together Molly, yeah. to sort of put, they bring a list of recipes to us based on our theme. And then we all sort of, the four of us sit down and narrow it down to what the final recipes are going to be for the issue.
Each issue is separated by course, so muse bouche and cocktails, starters, mains, desserts, and then we have cocktails in each issue as well. And then we also have kind of thematic chapters. This issue we did something on smoke and ash cooking, and also a chapter on hibernation, so food that kind of takes a while to develop its flavor. So we kind of have a few recipes in each chapter, and we are very cognizant of having vegetarian options, not having too much meat, but definitely having some meat, some spice, seasonal. Mixing it up, and keeping it really seasonal.
And how do you fit this in with your other jobs? I mean, it must be quite hard to put together a magazine while you're both working and doing other things.
Yeah, we have no life.
We haven't slept since we launched the magazine,
yeah.
But, you know, we couldn't ask for better. So
it's
this
a lot
is
of
like work
so
that
satisfying.
We love doing. Yeah. It's super satisfying for sure.
And you mentioned earlier that it's been more successful than you had initially anticipated. Why do you think that has been, and how have you kind of gauged your success?
I think we went in our first print run. We ended up doubling our first print run. And now this issue, we're doubling the total of what we printed the first time around just because of demand. We've done all the store reach out ourselves. And I think it's a lot of different types of people are responding to it. We sell in stores like Anthropology and West Elm, but we also sell in smaller boutiques like Project Number 8,
Kitchen,
right, Mohawk General in LA. So it's appealing to a wide variety of people, I think, and I think that's been kind of the key to our success so far. But
yeah.
It's been surprising. We kind of went into it thinking, we're just going to do something creative together. This is going to be really fun, and the response has been amazing.
Yeah, so, people are writing us and being like, I'm on an endeavor to cook every single recipe and gather. And that's so exciting to hear. Or someone wrote in that they were at a dinner party and the person made all recipes from gather. And that's how they found out about gather. And that was like the most satisfying thing to hear, that like they went to a dinner party and someone cooked from gather. Mm-hmm. And like, we were just like, that's it. You know, we've achieved what we wanted, you know.
And that was our Aisha Spears, our bureau chief in New York, talking to Michelle Outland and Fiorella Valdesolo from Gather. I will start with you, Charlotte. You've seen it before. What do you make of the magazine? I mean, you know, again, it is part of this, you know, new generation. There's no shortage of food magazines, even though we've seen a number of food magazines go by the wayside as well. And so there's, you know, there seems to be this new boom and interest in. Yeah, and almost sort of a movement of where we've seen sort of food blogs suddenly going on to paper as well. Not that I think this is far superior to that, but what are your thoughts?
I love it. I mean, once again, they've got a passion, and they've got a niche, and they're just getting out there and doing it, which I think is the most important thing. And I love the feel of the magazine. The photography is amazing. It looks like you just pick something up and eat it, and it just kind of, as soon as I open it, even though we have food in Betty, but that you can just tell the passion just kind of oozing from the pages.
Yeah, and the focus. Sebastian, I mean, probably, well, we were talking, we should have been listening to the package, but we were talking about Basra, and you were talking about the contrasts of what you can, you know, you have militia checkpoints, but you can also find stores that are well-stocked with salad dressings as well. Probably not a title that's going to launch in Iraq anytime soon. But I wanted to ask you, you know, in terms terms of, you know, what you see out there in Middle East publishing, sort of, you know, the quality of it. I mean, I've you know, you have one image of one set of magazines, which are, you know, the glossy, you know, super gloss magazines, and you'll have, of course, you know, some Arabic soap star probably from who spends a lot of time in studio lots in the suburbs of Cairo. Do you find it a dynamic, exciting place, or is just, you know, is just too much of the culture TV based? In the region,
in terms of publishing,
yeah.
Unfortunately, I mean, my knowledge is basically Iraq. Now, I've obviously seen Lebanese magazines, I've seen Egyptian magazines, I've seen Gulf magazines, and as you said, they are Turkish magazines. I mean, they are extremely high end, but towards the high gloss side of stuff. Even the even the Gulf business magazines are high gloss in terms of that. In Iraq, it's still very much newspaper-based, and the magazines are still very, very basic. And to be honest, because it's so new, and it's so new to Iraq, funding is an issue. So most of the funding, if not all of the funding, tends to be by political parties. So you're basically, at the very beginning, you're dealing much more with ethics. Those are the biggest concerns you have. In terms of design, that's very, very secondary. I would love to see Iraq, you know, blossom. I mean, they have the oil resources. The money is there. The desire is there. The aesthetic is there. I mean, you're talking about the oldest civilization on Earth. I mean, these guys invented humanity, if you want to say. Like, you know, they have the potential to be incredible, but it's still very much in its infancy.
We're going to go away for a break, but just before we go, I wanted to ask you, do you get a sense where the creative energy is, you know, where the heart? I mean, you know, is it Baghdad or is it, you know, if you go further north, you know, is it sitting in Erbil or where is it?
I would say it actually exists in Sulaymaniyah, the Kurdistan's second city. They consider themselves the artists of Kurdistan. That's their identity. There is a huge amount of creativity in Baghdad, but it is just smothered with bureaucracy. I mean, there's the obvious dangers of Baghdad, but really what's killing the creative industry in Iraq and in Baghdad in particular is just the militant bureaucracy.
We're talking to Sebastian Meyer and also Charlotte Jacqueline of Betty Magazine. You're listening to The Stack. We're going away for a short break. Back in a moment.
J.Crew understands that tradition and modernity often lie hand in hand. That often means looking back in time for inspiration, pairing the integrity of traditional design with modern desires to fit and comfort. As head menswear designer Frank Mauchin says,
we're always inspired by art, architecture, nature, and we look at classic historical menswear, vintage army gear, and those were garments with integrity because they served a purpose. To us, J.Crew is about understated masculine elegance, and we're constantly tweaking proportions to keep the fit current and modern without being trendy, and so we're always moving. What makes it modern, I think, is the fabric and the fit. It's like modern traditionalism almost. You know, like the details are traditional, but then the fit, the fabric and the color, that's where you get all your updates.
J.Crew.
Monocle's third annual Soft Power Survey is an attempt to push the debate on where soft power comes from and how to use it. And with current shifts in the global power balance, never has it been more relevant.
The unofficial yet undisputed leader of Europe relies on the strength of its business brands. While Angela Merkel has been hesitant to do what is necessary to drag the continent out of its economic malaise, Germany has just about enough in its soft power arsenal, from the Goethe Institute to the popularity of its football league, to keep it near the top.
From culture to sport, cuisine to diplomacy, find out which countries are best at wielding their weapons of soft power by watching our countdown in the programmes menu on monocle.com.
And And you're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Charlotte, I wanted you've got a few magazines there. You've got your current issue. I will give you a few moments to do a plug for. What issue number are we looking at there?
This is a little bit complicated, but this is the third printed issue, but issue 5. But this is number 3 in the print.
Okay. Is that a long explanation as to why that is? Or
this is number 3.
Okay, fine. We will leave it there. Leave it at that. Just the idea when you set out to put an issue together, how big is your team?
The whole team.
Don't fudge the numbers. Just so
the whole team is about 13, 14 at the moment. But you know, we've got about 5 writers that we work with on a regular basis. There's just so many different people that we work with all the time.
The first time I saw the magazine was actually in Japan. This is what I think is always curious about publishing, especially a title which is niche, which has its market like yours does. As we all know, it's very hard, even for something like we do, to get into the likes of W.H. Smith and things like that. I mean, after trying and beating them up, it does happen. But I discovered this in Tokyo first, and is that also, not just Japan, but where this magazine sort of primarily resides, more in of course, specialist newsstands at the hands of very passionate newsagents?
Yeah, I mean, the Japanese order was our first ever order. Even before I thought about putting it into print, they were emailing saying, where can we get this? We want 100. Like, right, okay. And that was kind of the motivation to put it into print. We're in Selfridges, Harvey Nichols, Paper Chase. And I don't know if we'd ever sit in the likes of W.H. Smith. I don't know if that would work for us. People know, if you're a magazine fiend, who has got the best magazine department, and you can go there. And at the moment, you can find us in London and various places, but we're just trying to find new places to.
Are you a magazine which just happens to be published in London? I mean, you mentioned, the point about the Japanese sort of took to it first. I think it's always sort of curious to ask publishers, is this something that you could do anywhere, do you think, or is there something peculiar or particularly UK about this?
I think it's very British, Betty, and I think that's what stands us apart from many of the other magazines. We're printed in Wales, all our contributors. Well, we have a few internationally, but it is very kind of English centric, and I think that's really important. It's a little bit got that kind of wackiness to it, I think, that is very British, and that's what kind of the American readers and the Japanese readers, that's what they enjoy about it. So I think we're always kind of quite conscious to stay loyal to that.
Is UK your biggest market, or in fact is America your biggest market, or Australia or somewhere?
Yeah, UK is our biggest, and then Japan, and now we got a lot of orders from the USA. I'm looking at Singapore, and we've got a lot of interest in Australia, but once again it's the logistics of it, how do we get it out there?
Sebastian, you were talking just earlier again during the break, and just just signaling your concern about just the state of photojournalism, and looking at a title like this, and you're looking at Gath earlier saying just this sort of wonderful attention to photography, but your fears, is it because everyone has a mobile phone at the moment? Is it because I talked at the very beginning about consolidation that's happening with the big agencies? Where does that fear lie?
Fear lies, I think, in all of it. Fear lies in the fact that so much publishing is done online, and that online content is free. I mean, whether it is or it isn't, that's how the world approaches it, and that's all there is to it. I mean, if you go to the New York Times and you fill up your 20 articles, you think that you deserve 20 articles for free, and then you deserve to get the rest for free, and you'll find a way to do it. And I certainly use the internet thinking that everything's supposed to be free. So there's that aspect that content doesn't get paid for by the viewer anymore. And then also part of it is the fact that, everybody has a phone, and everybody, all those phones take pictures. So the value of photography has certainly decreased. There's also been, and we have to recognize this, a huge flood of photographers into the market. I remember there was an interview done with Patrick Baz, who's the AFP Middle East Bureau Chief, photo Bureau Chief. And he was saying when he started working in Lebanon 20 years ago, there were just fewer photographers. Now you go to, I was in Libya, I was in Syria, you go in there and there are just tons of people. You know, they realize they can cross the border, that they have a right as just as much as anybody else with a camera to cross over, and they do. And then so the market is flooded with not only amateur photography, but also with professional photography. And it is just a very, very difficult market. That's all there is to it.
Do you think that the reader, the magazine consumer, the newspaper consumer, do they care about bylines when it's a big story? Mm-hmm. Are they interested? Okay, that is the person who is on the ground. That's the person that's been commissioned. Does that still matter?
It's hard to say because I've been doing this now for almost 10 years, and so I pay attention to the byline. I know who the photographer is. It means something to me. Unfortunately, I don't think it matters at all. I think the byline of the author of the article is important. Not important, but people recognize it. Certainly Anthony Shadid was a big name, and, you know, people knew. Nicholas Kristof is a big, I mean, he writes op-eds, so it, you know, his personality is important. But no, I don't think people pay much attention to the photographers. I think if you ask most people and ask them, can you name one photojournalist? I don't think they could.
Mm. Charlotte, you know, it's in fact, in many ways, it's the same topic. If I think back sort of, you know, 20 years ago, and I would look at, you know, the great British style magazines, you would focus on, you know, okay, that's, you know, there's this incredible story by Nick Knight, and that was, you know, something which was shot by Herb Ritts, and certainly, you know, that sort of being the era of sort of, you know, the mega sort of fashion star. Do you think your audience, you know, is also concerned by who the stylist is, who shot that cover image? Because it's probably important, of course, to you and your, your creative or art director. But again, I'm wondering if that sort of culture still exists, if the consumer today, you know, in the style sector has a concern about the provenance of that image.
Yeah, I mean, me and the team, definitely. I've got my favourite stylists, editors, writers, and I know the whole team do. Necessarily the people that are reading it, not so much, but I don't think that's what they'd come to Betty for.
Mm.
But I think they are very aware. You know, there's cults, underground kind of girl fan clubs about editors such as Leith Clark from Lula magazine. I think people are very kind of conscious still. It's kind of, once again, it's a little bit of a niche, and it's a little bit of a girl club or group. Have you read the latest article by so and so? Have you seen the latest shoot by this person? So, but I don't think it is, as you say, as it was, you know, kind of 10, 15 years ago. It's a bit more democratic, I think.
Now, let's see what else you brought in today. What do you want to look at next? We've had a quick whiz through the new issue of Betty. What do you have there?
I've brought Jackie, which is now defunct.
Yes.
But, you know, I read a lot of magazines that aren't published anymore that I search for on eBay, like old issues of Nova magazine and things. So I've brought Jackie in.
Now, for those listeners who are not familiar with Jackie, who might be listening to us potentially in Baghdad or somewhere in the South Pacific, set up Jackie for me.
Okay, so Jackie is a weekly magazine that was around in the 60s, and it ran till 1993. I think they did 1,500 issues. Sorry, but it's very dated when you look at it now. But I like it for the typography. I love the old adverts in it. We draw a lot of inspiration from that. Let's see what's on the strap lines. There's a lot of cartoons inside as well.
Mm.
But you know, We really enjoy vintage magazines at Betty.
And you look at it and you said sort of dated because of its naivete, or, I mean, you know, aside from, you know, someone having a very large Dickie bow on the front cover, but what is it exactly?
I think, yeah, the naivety definitely is an aspect of it, and then the style as well. You know, you look at things that are 5 years old and they're dated. So looking at this from 1978, it looks incredibly dated, but the actual just topic of the articles, yeah, and what they're talking about, just things that you don't necessarily find in weeklies, you know, now. There's no celebrities in here apart from the middle spread. Hold on. Sorry if I'm making loads of shuffling noise.
No, that's good. It's a show about show about paper. It's all right.
Where is the middle spread?
Do you think that there is a, while you look for that, is there room for weeklies still? I mean, you know, Sebastian, you were talking about, you know, it's difficult to find the likes of Time magazine and the logistics of getting, you know, just things well, certainly into in Iraq is quite complicated. But Charlotte, do you think that, you know, of course, you've got sort of the cult of Grazia here, which seems to, you know, continue, maybe not doing as well as it did when it launched, but it's still got a fan base. So the weekly, does it have a place still in, you know, the women's shopping basket, in the handbag, et cetera, as, you know, in an era when, of course, you could be consuming everything, you know, on a device?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I look around at all my friends. They've got Look magazine, Grazia. I mean, I flick through them, but it's not something that I particularly, you know, is my passion. But I think until people slow down a little bit, fashion slows down, life slows down, people, you know, they want the new thing. You know, if there was a daily magazine, I'm sure they'd read it. You know, things just keep getting quicker and quicker, and people just keep consuming.
So what do you think, Sebastian? I mean, we've been talking about this a lot on this program. Hardly a week goes by we don't mention, yeah, Newsweek will not be with us any longer. You know, in a couple of weeks, I think, what is it? You know, probably 2 weeks. Maybe this could even be the last issue hitting newsstand. You know, Time Magazine is there. I think there's even question marks around that as well. And you know, given what you do, a title which does very well, you know, The Economist, not exactly a great magazine for you when it comes to photography.
Exactly. One of the sad truths about it is that for a photographer, online is actually you get more of your work shown. And it gets shown every picture. Nothing has to be cropped. And there's lots of online spaces for great photography. I mean, there's the New York Times Lens blog, there's Time Magazine's Lightbox. There's more prestige in being put in the printed edition. But online, you actually get a much bigger show. Even National Geographic. I mean, you do a 20-25 picture slideshow. Now, obviously, it looks awesome when you have a double page spread in the center of National Geographic.
Yeah.
But as a photographer, you know, you spend 2 months on an assignment for National Geographic, and you get, I don't know, 10, 15 pictures in the magazine. You get 25 online. So it's a hard balance between sort of the ego and prestige of being in the printed edition or actually getting more stuff shown online.
We're going to be hearing a little bit more about the culture of weekly or weeklies in a moment when we're going to be chatting with Olivier Hoyon, who is the editor-in-chief of Paris Match. You are listening to The Stack. We are live in London. We're back in a moment.
The designers at J. Crew feel that the best garments involve a mix of smart detail and solid functional design. As head menswear designer Frank Malchens explains, J. Crew's favorite products are the ones that start with smart design but last long enough to make them the customer's own.
It's, to me, the Lolo is a classic suit, but with a modern edge almost, but without it being trendy. And I think what we are in J. Crew here is we're looking for longevity and for classic garments which can lead a life. Like if you have a khaki pant, we make sure it's nicely washed already again, but you still have to do the work yourself again. You know, like year after year, the wash gets better and it gets softer and it molds around your body. The same goes for denim. And I think also that's a way to give a garment personality.
J. Crew.
And you're back here in Studio One at Midori House, where we've just been joined by a very special guest who popped in. I knew you were going to be coming because Mr. Mario Garcia, a good friend of ours who was in this very seat yesterday, said that you're in town. Olivier Hoyon, editor-in-chief of Paris Match. Welcome.
Good morning.
Now, tell me, we won't go into the full details of why you're in town, but let's jump across the channel at the moment and then come back again. How does London feel to you at the moment, just given the spike we've seen in the French community? I mean, there's always been many, because not too far from the offices of Paribas are just on the other side of Marylebone Road. It's always been rather French around here, but certainly running up to the election, after the election, the city has dramatically changed.
You mean you believe that when a French guy show up in New York, in London, is this to escape France these days and to build a new base in London or in Belgium? Because that's what's the story in France this week about Gérard Depardieu leaving France for Belgium. So it's a major crisis of identity, I would say. Mm. Will the French will face, I mean, many contradictions in the year 2013. with the new government, all these questions that has been raised also in Italy, in Spain, there is a moment when you hit the wall, and I think that's the very moment. So I hope we end up with a rebound at the end of the 2013. But there are major thinking, and it seems that many older questions, like during the revolution, came out again. I mean, like the rich versus the poor, anti-capitalism movement that we are seeing in the west part of France, where this anti-mondialists are fighting the installation of a new airport. So you have all this big movement, traditional in France, and you don't exactly know what's going to come out of this.
I wonder, of course, Paris-Match every week, I mean, you're covering a wide variety of topics. But when you look at the French landscape right now, as an editor-in-chief, how much do you have to have bread and circuses? How much do you have to, do you feel, just given the state of your magazine, you have to look at the landscape and what goes on day in and day out, but also how much do you have to be there to also, inspire, entertain right now as well, keep a buoyant mood?
Oh, I think it's very important. We have to keep in mind that the mission of a magazine, and we are a generalist magazine that was launched in the 50s, so this is you could call it as a dinosaur, surviving the dinosaur, like Stern magazine or Time. And you have to keep in mind that people expect from their magazine to evade, to go somewhere else, to escape the daily life. So you have to produce these stories about something else. This week we are producing a 14-page story of Sebastião Salgado, the Brazilian photographer, that spent a month with the Nenets, these people in the northern part of Siberia. I mean, this has nothing to do with our daily life, but people expect this from the magazine. Big photos, big layout, and the importance of the pictures. And we are covering the crisis. We send crews covering the issue of poverty, because one of the ministers was telling me last week that, it's unbelievable, but maybe in 2013 you will have kids in France suffering from malnutrition, which is something unbelievable. I mean, what's going on in Europe these days are you couldn't expect this kind of themes rising. But at the same time, so if you have to keep a two-track magazine, one hand covering the news, covering this all these issues and trying to get some answer to the people, and at the other end, don't hesitate to think out of the box, to produce stories that are that surprise. I mean, we have to keep surprising and keep this emotion of the stories.
One of the stories that's really been fascinating us here, because I would say, perhaps a focus always in the magazine and print, but also in radio, we look at this notion of provenance and where are things made. And we've seen on the ministerial side in France, this big push for made in France, not even fabriqué en France, but made in France, is a really big push. This kind of industrial nationalism it has always been a big theme. And I'm wondering, what is your view on that?
Tyler, I was in French Institute of Political Studies, that was 30 years ago, we were learning the list of these big companies, these major conglomerates that were exporting and producing the label, the French label, all over the world. You'll find out these days that the Netherlands are exporting more products than we do. So there is this major rethinking about what should we produce. I mean, this is this. We have to keep in mind that we are entering an era of this is exactly the opposite of what used to be, which is we have now in an industrial era again. We have to produce if you want to exist, and it's not simply selling services. So we find out that our cost of labor is very high. 56% of our GDP is from the public service. So if you want to produce better, you have to increase the productivity of this public service or you have to reduce it. I mean, so this is a major rethinking. Traditionally in France, the public sector has been helping has been used as a cushion versus against the crisis or against this kind of situation. These days, the public sector is not enough and is not sufficient to increase the productivity. You have to create. You have to produce new stuff. And I don't know. Well, it's going to take a while because you cannot decree this. This is not something that you decide as a government.
No.
It takes a while to put innovation in the industry again. It's put a while to put R&D and all these things.
Let's talk about the job that both of us do day in and day out, which is getting a magazine out the door. You talked about the Nenet story and sending Mr. Salgado up to the Arctic Circle in Siberia. You're still committed to, you have your teams, you have people, I guess, every week in the newsroom, their bags are packed, they're ready to go around the world. I mean, the Salgado story is a different thing, but you're always ready to deploy people. The world stage is still absolutely essential. At a time, before we went on air, you were talking about just, you know, the bureau cutbacks we see at other weeklies. The relationship between what you have to do domestically and then also internationally, how do you see it?
I think there are two kinds of media these days. The media who have the capabilities and the resources to report their own news, which means sending people on the field, and you have the media commenting about the news that other media bring back. So we are definitely in the first category. I mean, the worst thing for me would be to have a submarine Paris match that is the news, the evening news on the TV. We don't want this. So we have to go on the field. We report the news. And it's amazing. You're talking about Twitter, Facebook, and all the social networks. The thing is, when you don't have professional reporters or professional photographers on the field, you don't get out many news out of Aleppo or the city in Syria. I mean, you need to get professional photographers and professional reporters on the field to get this kind of news. And I don't see an opposition between the rise of the social media as a new way to get informed. But the thing is, you need to go on the field. I mean, I don't, my idea of journalists facing their computer 24 hours a day is not my idea of a journalist. I think a journalist should be on the beat, should be covering the news on the field.
Mm. Tell us. Aside from all of the challenges that one has with newsstand and subscriptions and high postal prices, and all of us face this all over the world every day, anything on the horizon in France right now? New competition in terms of new magazines, newspapers, new supplements? What is the feeling on the street?
It's amazing because it's an absolutely overcrowded field. And companies, media companies, keep on launching magazines like new products. So you have about 4,400 magazines in France. So it's a very crowded field. But we expect, for example, Condé Nast to launch the French version of Vanity Fair in 2013. So that will be an interesting thing. And you have Le Parisien, the daily newspaper, launching also a supplement on Friday. So it's amazing, and no magazine dies. So it's a crowded field. It's interesting. I think the economy and the economic model of the magazine is very different from the dailies. You are talking about private time. I mean, this is a layback situation, and magazine keep on being part of the private life. The private garden of the people, and that's a very, very important. It's a good opportunity for us, I guess.
Mm. And in terms of Paris Match and your growth right now, very much a fixture, of course, as a weekly. But we've seen so many brands, of course, having to diversify and do other things. Two questions. How has the tablet worked for you so far? Because I think many have focused on France as being, you know, a market which is a little bit resistant. Conservative in some senses when it comes to new technology, maybe being, you know, deliberately slow, which is no bad thing. So how has that played out, and what are the other plans in terms of new projects?
We decided at Paris Match, we were on the tablet the first day, and it was very important for us. We decided that we would go on the higher road, which is the most difficult, which is to aim at an enriched content. The tablets is there to provide you more than what the print does, because of we have videos, we have sound, we have many more photographs. This is paying now because we have after 2 years into the tablet development, we are seeing numbers, which means by thousands, which was not the case 2 years ago. So the tablets allow us to go to the to make Paris Match discover to a new public, younger, that believed that Paris Match was their father or their mother's magazine. I mean, these people, they are discovering our values, discovering our identity through the tablets. So it is very important. The tablets for us are the journalists. We are fed up about putting our content for free on the internet. I mean, this is key, and the tablets are something that allows us to protect our value, our journalistic value, and our professional value, which is big. So, and it's a creative tool. So, but I don't think the tablet and the print are going hand by hand. I mean, they are very close. We are a magazine that is an object, like your magazine is an object. So the relationship of the readers with the readers is also built on this object. And I don't want to give up this object because it's a wonderful object. I mean, the magazine remains something wonderful. I mean, that you can touch. It's a feeling. It's a sensual experience. And I don't want to give up this for the tablet. But the tablets will do fine. And they will allow us to also to have a new relationship with the advertisers, with the brands. So we'll see. And it's a new media. I mean, only 2 years ago, if you remember the radio or the television in two years into the development, I mean, the tablets are just an extraordinary development.
Great. Olivier Rouen, editor-in-chief of Paris Match, thank you very much. We're back in a moment. That was us talking to Olivier Royan of Paris Match a little bit earlier. Sebastian, it was fascinating listening to him because, you know, he talked about, you know, the importance of doing the big stories, and just listening to him commissioning, you know, Sebastian Salgado to go up and cover the Nenets, and you get this 14-page story sending a photojournalist up to the Siberian Arctic Circle for a month. I mean, those days are sort of largely gone. I mean, save for what, maybe 4 or 5 magazines around the world can probably still do that. Their pockets are deep enough.
Absolutely. I mean, I think National Geographic, I mean, the big weeklies, I think, you know, Stern and Time and National Geographic. But yeah, I just don't think that world exists anymore for photojournalists, which is, you know, that's fine. We got to move with the times, but we just got to have to find a different model to make it work.
And therein lies the problem. You know, people struggling to find that model because, you know, I think the other point that he makes, and you know, we were you know, chatting about it maybe in a slightly more tangential way, is that, you know, he said, you know, there won't be a conversation. What a lot of people forget is that, you know, if you don't have people on the ground who are there willing to take a risk, he said, there's not going to be a lot of chatter in social media because you still need people who are there on the front lines, living it, doing it. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think relying on untrained and unskilled citizen journalists, I think, is very, very dangerous. And there's a lot of material that started coming out of Syria early on, a lot of, you know, things posted on YouTube. And it was found out not too soon afterwards that a lot of it was made up. A lot of the Syrian activism, although, you know, that horrible things were happening, but a lot of it was totally fake. I mean, people were burning tires in the background to give the impression that a bomb had just struck. And it hadn't.
Mm.
And you rely on, as a news consumer, you rely on the ethics of whether it's the BBC or whether it's New York Times or whether it's Monocle. You rely on their fact checking. And if your publications are relying on people that they don't necessarily trust, well, you know, then I don't know where we end up in a very, very bad place, I think.
Mm. Charlotte, do you think that we come into a new era of accountability now, not just for, this is, you know, the one thing, it's that, you know, titles like ours are all the ones we're discussing, you can come after us because we have an address, of course we have bank accounts as well, so, you know, that also makes it more interesting. But, you know, what do you think about this notion of sort of accountability on the side of, well, you know, you as an editor and journalist, but also on the side of, you know, with a surge in social media, on the side of people who just want to go and post things and perhaps not considering it?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, we were just chatting in the break, but I think people need to realize that Twitter, Facebook, it is a micro form of publishing. And if you're going to make a statement or 140 characters, you need to think about it and you need to realize that it's there for all to see. And And people do need to have responsibility.
Mm. I mean, not next week, 2 weeks, we're going to be taking a bit of a look over the horizon, where things are going to go in 2013. But I'll ask both of you before we go, do you know, what's your view? Do you think that there should be more regulation? Not in terms of censorship, but I mean, in the same way that someone has to edit the letters page of the Wall Street Journal and make sure that no one, you know, there's no defamatory statements. When you look at, I think, all of these, you know, media channels are out there, what do you think, Sebastian? Should there be some level of accountability on the side of people who are also carrying these things as well?
Accountability on the side of the social media. Mm. So it's absolutely. I mean, as we were talking during the break about things that happened in the past, people posting things on Facebook that have led to suicide. I think that Facebook can't really say that they're not somewhat responsible for that, even if they're just the, as you said, micro publishing. They hold responsibility somewhere in there.
Mm. Charlotte, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I don't have too much to add, but it's something needs to be looked at, and you know the media is regulated, and you know, why aren't social media sites not to the point of censorship where it constrains us from doing something, but something needs to kind of be in place.
I was just going to say as well, I didn't give it away, but I will give it away at the end of the program. We managed to get through 60 minutes without Sebastian bringing in any magazines, which is amazing. It's the first time that this has happened in 16 programs. But it was absolutely brilliant to hear what you're up to. And also, I think, what's happening out there in the market. So, Sebastian Meyer, thanks very much for that. And also, the new magazine, the new issue of Betty Out, Charlotte Jacqueline, editor there. Thanks very much for coming on. That brings us to the end of this 16th edition of The Stack. Our producers today were Don Trump and Adrian Craddock. Our studio manager was Chris Fitch. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time, and then the week after that, it's going to be our best ofs, and then we'll be taking a look ahead as well. This program is going to be going on the road. We're going to be up in St. Moritz for the holiday season. In fact, from the 26th of December right through till January 1st, 2 hours live every day is going to be coming from the heart of the Engadine Valley. So do tune in to that. Coming up, though, in a moment, Georgina Godwin is going to be back. And then at midday, we are going to have both Emma Nelson and my colleague Sophie Grove are going to be here in the studio with the review. But now for me, for all of us here, I'm Tyler Burleigh. Goodbye. Have a very good weekend.